content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On last week's program, we were reading about Project Recover, a nonprofit that works to recover fallen planes and repatriate skeletons from World War II. So this article is titled Up from the Depths by Stephen Mim, a World War II recovery mission. 80 years after Avenger 17018 was shot down over the Pacific, will its pilot finally come home? We'll pick up when they're on in the middle of their mission off the coast of Palau. One afternoon a week later, toward day's end, a large crane reels up the first recovery basket of the mission, steering it to a soft landing on the back of the barge. The team members swarm around it, peering intently at the contents. Large twisted pieces of metal, some scorched and warped by fire, and several mysterious sections of black rubber. One by one, the artifacts come out, gently cradled and placed on a tarp. The black rubber turns out to be swaths of the fuel bladder, its white stenciled serial number still bright and legible. Then comes a piece of the bomb bay door, its hydraulics still attached, skeins of electrical wires, and a handful of indignant crabs, which are promptly returned to the sea. The most evocative items are the smallest, a piece of bakelite, likely from a radio, a strand of silk parachute cord still intact, and most haunting of all, spent rounds from a 50 caliber machine gun that turret gunner DePetta fired as the plane came under attack. They went down fighting, a young diver murmurs, turning the relic over in his hand. The next day, another basket comes up. This one contains pieces of the cockpit, including Manown's rudder pedals and his control stick. Manown was the pilot of this plane. The most revealing artifact, though, is a half-inch thick armor plate the size and shape of a large baking sheet. It was meant to protect Manown's upper torso from stray flak. The upper left quadrant, though, is missing, leaving behind a jagged, warped edge. Scannon points at the torn steel. He probably took a direct hit from an anti-aircraft round. It would have killed him instantly. That evening, everyone returns to their hotel rooms back on shore, feeling especially hopeful. With artifacts from the cockpit laid out on the deck, there is a sense among the team that they are getting close. But the next morning, a tropical storm grazes the islands. The wind and waves snap one of the cables anchoring the barge, putting the operation on hold. For 2 days, everyone hunkers in their hotel rooms as sheets of rain inundate the islands. When the weather finally clears, the team eagerly returns to the barge. A large metal basket filled with many cubic feet of sediment earlier in the week is hauled from the depths. Once it touches down on deck, team members remove the heavy cover, revealing a visually confusing mix of shells, scraps of metal, chunks of coral, and pebbles. Blake Boteller, a team member and former agent with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, sees it first. A small piece of what looks like gray coral. It is splintered on one end. He picks it up wordlessly and hands it over to Vice, who turns it over in her hand and nods. A piece of a tibia, she says. Later, she explains that this was a provisional identification. Only DPAA, that's the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, has the authority to make an official determination about what it calls osseous remains. Team members now begin transferring the contents of the basket to 5-gallon plastic pails and bringing them to the screening station, which hangs off the back of the barge. Screening sediment is a simple process, but takes time. You take a pail and dump the contents into a shallow wooden tray lined with wire mesh. Then you use a hose to wash away the sand and silt, leaving anything larger than a behind that's a leaving behind anything larger than a quarter of an inch. Scan and Boteller begin work, joined by Derek Abbey, a longtime team member who was among the group that found pieces of Manown's Avenger on the nearby island. former Marine who piloted F-18 Hornets, Abby took over as Project Recover's chief executive officer in 2019, though Scanna remains heavily involved in day-to-day operations. No one at the screening station says much. The sounds of running water dominates. As the sand washes away, the screen reveals the usual mix of shells and coral fragments, but also much more. Shards of clear, red, and green glass, which evidently came from an instrument panel, knobs and dials, and additional items that look likely to have come from the cockpit. Then someone finds a piece of curved gray material. It resembles a shell, but when shown the object, Vice says it's a piece of cranium. Soon what appears to be more bones surface in the screens, another possible skull fragment, a likely bone from a foot, and other pieces, each recorded in a log by Vice. As the operation winds down, many other artifacts come to light. A piece of the plane's communication system, a button from a flight uniform, and finally a small circle of metal that some cleaning and polishing reveals to be a nickel, quite possibly from the pilot's pocket, perhaps a talisman or charm. The coin is dated 1941, the year of the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, setting in motion the sequence of events that would lead to the deaths of Manoun and his crew, and in the fullness of time, the presence of everyone on the deck that day. The likely bone fragments were sent directly to Oahu, Hawaii, for intake at DPAA's state-of-the-art forensics facility, the largest skeletal identification laboratory in the world. The structure is a gleaming, light-filled building with two wings. From a distance, it looks a bit like a plane. The lab houses dozens of active-duty forensic scientists who specialize in handling and analyzing human remains, typically working with photographs of missing service members in plain view, a constant reminder of the gravity of their charge. These scientists carefully collate, record, and analyze the bones and teeth, along with any personal effects recovered. To make a positive identification, they make use of evidence such as the location of the remains relative to the wreckage, the presence of items belonging to the deceased, comparisons with dental records, typically those recorded in military personnel files, and dog tags. But these methods are suggestive, not dispositive. DNA evidence, on the other hand, when compared with DNA taken from cheek swabs of the deceased's relatives, can provide conclusive identification, a process that can take months and sometimes years. Until that time, the military won't comment on the status of any investigation, not even to family members, including, for now, Manoun's. Once a case is closed, however, the remains are sent to the closest surviving family members and given a full military funeral. Project Recover members frequently attend these funerals, as many did in September when Wilbur Mitz was laid to rest in Seaside, California. Diana Ward, Mitz's niece and oldest living relative, sat beneath a canopy at the gravesite, surrounded by dozens of family members. She never met her uncle, she said during her eulogy, having been born 3 days after his plane was shot down in Palau. But she described how he remained a palpable presence during her childhood. The family sang his favorite songs and nurtured his memory as if he might one day return. Her account is typical of many surviving relatives of MIAs. With no body to mourn, survivors experience what psychologists call ambiguous loss. Deprived of the closure of a conclusive death, family members dwell in a peculiar purgatory that can carry over from one generation to the next. Perhaps this help explains why Mitz's funeral felt more like a celebration than anything else. The dead cannot come back to life, but they can come home. As the coffin was lowered into the ground, Zaborski quietly approached Ward. He knelt beside her and the two spoke privately for several minutes before he hugged her and returned to Project Recover team members who were standing in a circle nearby. At a reception afterwards, Scanna mused on the meaning of it all. If the remains he and his team found over the summer are ultimately proved to belong to Manoun, Scanna said, he'd find it eerie, if a little fitting, that the plane's junior crew members had been found first. When a plane is headed for a crash, there's an important role that the pilot or commander is the last one to bail out, he explained. In a way, then, it's appropriate that DePetta and Mitz came home first. Time will tell whether Manoun will come home, too. His Avenger will not. The government of Palau considers the plane, like other wrecks and relics from World War II, a part of the nation's historical heritage, which is why, A few months earlier, on the expedition's final day, the team collected all the pieces of the bomber the divers had recovered during the excavation. Under a dark gray sky, they wrapped the plane parts in a burial shroud made of wire mesh and secured it with a rope. As everyone gathered to watch, the crane lifted the giant bundle and brought it out over the water before gently lowering it until it rested just below the surface. A single diver jumped aboard and, dodging whitecaps, swam out to the rope. He pulled a knife from the sheath strapped to his legs and cut the line. The shattered pieces of Manon's plane vanished from view, reunited with the rest of the wreckage in the darkness below. Next, we'll move to an article titled The Art of the Scam by Jordan Michael Smith. A decades-long forgery scheme ensnared Canada's most famous Indigenous artist, a rock musician turned sleuth, and several top museums. How investigators unraveled the biggest art fraud in history. Norval Morisseau was certain. "I did not paint the attached 23 acrylics on canvas," he wrote in a typed letter in 2001 to his Toronto gallery representative, who had sent him color photocopies of works that had recently sold at an unrelated auction. Morisseau, then in his late 60s and suffering from Parkinson's disease, was the most important artist in the modern history of Canada's Indigenous peoples, the Picasso of the North. He single-handedly invented the Woodland School of Art, which fused European and Indigenous traditions to create striking, vibrant images featuring thick black lines and colorful interiors of humans, animals, and plants, as though they had been X-rayed and their insides were visible and filled with unusual parts and patterns and shapes. He was one of the first Indigenous painters to garner national attention and the first to have a solo exhibition at the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. Few exhibits in Canadian art history have touched off a greater immediate stir, swooned the Canadian edition of Time magazine after Morisseau's sold-out 1962 debut exhibition in Toronto. By 2001, Morisseau paintings routinely fetched thousands of dollars on the market. The works he now denied having painted were no exception. The auctioneer had advertised them as being from Morisseau's hand and claimed to a reporter writing about the dispute that though he had obtained the paintings from an obscure seller, he had no reason to doubt their authenticity. He had already sold 800 of them without a single buyer's complaint. Morisseau, though justifiably incensed, wasn't surprised that imitations of his work were being sold as authentic on the open market. As early as 1991, the Toronto Star reported that artist was complaining about being ripped off by fraudsters. But for years, Canadian law enforcement did little to investigate the artist's claims that forgers were imitating his work. Eventually, in the face of this inaction, Morisseau's lawyers advised him to notify galleries and auctioneers that they were selling fakes and warn them that they could be subject of a court injunction, civil action, or criminal complaint. Still, the sales went on. It wasn't until the past year, more than 15 years after the artist died from complications related to Parkinson's, that an unlikely consortium of investigators, led by a homicide cop from the small city of Thunder Bay, Ontario, finally exposed the scheme to defraud Morisseau. Not even the artist himself could have imagined the scale of the fraud, which in both the number of forged paintings and the profits made from their sale was likely the biggest art fraud in history, not in Canada or North America, but anywhere in the world. Morisseau was born in the early 1930s. Consistent with Anishinaabe traditions, he was raised by his maternal grandparents on a reserve near Thunder Bay belonging to the Anishinaabe. Reserves were, and largely remain, small, poor, unproductive lands where the Canadian government had forced Indigenous people to live. Morisseau's grandmother was Catholic, and her grandfather, a shaman, taught him his people's spiritual traditions. Fusing white and Indigenous cultures, rather than segregating them, would define Morisseau's life and art. When Morisseau was six, Canadian officials abducted him and sent him to a residential school. These infamous boarding schools were established by the federal government in the late 19th century. As at their counterparts in the United States, Indigenous students were stripped of their language, culture, community, and family ties, and were forcibly assimilated into the dominant white Christian culture. In both countries, students also frequently endured physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. And Morisseau later said that he'd endured sexual assault at school. among the experiences that caused lasting psychological and emotional damage, leaving him vulnerable to addictions to alcohol and drugs. By age 10, Morisot had returned to his grandparents' reserve and become a budding artist, drawing and painting forbidden things. In Anishinaabe tradition, it was verboten to make visual art based on sacred oral traditions and myths. As he grew serious about his work during his teens and early 20s, he attracted criticism in the community. A lot of elders and Anishinaabe didn't agree with what Norval was doing and what he was expressing in his paintings, says Dallas Thompson, an Anishinaabe man who knew one of Morisot's relatives. At the time, Canada prohibited Indigenous people from practicing their cultures, laws that were enforced until 1951. By putting spiritual material into his work, Morisot was defying both colonial and Indigenous pressures while fashioning a new artistic style that injected Anishinaabe ideas into Western art. His big, bold works were filled with swirls of bright paints portraying people and animals as receptacles for ancient spiritual myths. He viewed his art as a sort of therapy, and not necessarily for himself. "Why am I alive?" he once said. "To heal you guys who are more screwed up than I am. How can I heal you? With color." Morisot became an instant celebrity in 1962, after a Toronto gallery owner named Jack Pollock, no relation to Jackson, discovered Morisot and began displaying his work, marking the first time an Indigenous painter's work was shown in a contemporary Canadian gallery. The impact on the country's art world was immediate and enormous. Every painting sold the first day. Eventually, Morisot became a practicing shaman and began signing his paintings with the name Copper Thunderbird, given to him as part of a healing ceremony. Before long, his art was included in shows in England, Norway, Germany, and the U.S. Morisot was known to friends and collaborators as soft-spoken but wry. Pollock called him eccentric, mad, brilliant. In a National Film Board of Canada short released in 1974, Morisot sits among his works wearing a purple vest and a purple shirt and a painted brown vest. He says that a great spirit promised to guide him and look after him. "What more protection do I want?" Morisot says to the documentarian. "I don't need to go to a big cathedral." Morisot, who was bisexual, married a woman and fathered 7 children, but later became estranged from his family. He was indifferent to celebrity, polite society, and the worship of money. He also struggled with alcoholism and hard drug use. Gilbert Cartier, his personal assistant in the late 1970s, recalls that Morisot once rolled a joint with a $1,000 bill and smoked it. As his addictions deepened in the late 1980s, the artist lived in poverty in northern Ontario and western Canada, while his paintings commanded huge sums on the market and enjoyed prime placement in the country's most elite arts institutions. His indifference to bourgeois society sometimes got him into trouble. In a 1989 memoir, Pollock, who died in 1992, recalled that in 1978, Morisot began selling paintings to an antiques dealer who also served as a front for the mob. Soon, the mafia were giving Morisot unsigned paintings and mechanically produced silkscreen prints and bribing him to sign them. Others who knew him confirmed that Morisot was willing to lend his name to works he hadn't entirely created himself. Cartier recalled to me that the painter's half-brother, Wolf Morisot, once needed money for eyeglasses, and Morisot wondered if the optometrist would accept paintings as barter. When Wolf said the doctor would, Morisot had Wolf create some paintings, and then the artist signed the images himself. On another occasion, Morisot appeared to have signed his name to works created by one of his proteges. There is a long tradition, of course, of visual artists using friends, collaborators, and apprentices to help produce, quote-unquote, original works. Michelangelo employed assistants to paint the Sistine Chapel. Andy Warhol had a virtual assembly line of helpers, appropriately called the Factory, which allowed him to pump out huge numbers of pieces. Morisot's approach was similar. Every single artist, when they get to a certain level of productivity, well, not everyone, but a large body of them, has assistants, apprentices, says Corey Dingle, executive director of the Morisot Estate. Still, according to Cartier, Pollock warned Morisot that he was jeopardizing the market with his quasi-frauds, which would surely proliferate. And that's exactly what happened, Cartier says. In 2001, Canada's National Post newspaper broke the news that Morisseau was accusing the auction house outside Toronto of selling fakes. In response, some auctioneers and art retailers impugned Morisseau's ability to authenticate his own material, claiming, for example, that Morisseau didn't remember what art he had created because his Parkinson's and drinking had impaired his memory. Morisseau would make paintings for food or liquor, the president of a Toronto auction house told the National Post. You give him acrylic paint and a canvas and tell him you'll take him out to dinner and give him some liquor and he'll paint. But those close to Morisseau maintain that the artist was not suffering from impaired cognition. Moreover, his attorneys and approved dealers pointed to clear differences between authentic Morisseau works and those the artist was disputing. For one thing, Morisseau almost always signed works with his shaman's name, Copper Thunderbird, and Cree syllabics on the front, never illegibly on the back of the painting, never in English, and certainly never with a copyright symbol. All three of these erroneous features were present in some of the fakes. For another, the provenance of the disputed paintings, their history of ownership, was vague and could not be traced to Morisseau. Sometimes the painting smelled of markers, which the artist never used. Other paintings had misspelled titles on the back, and the images confused the indigenous spiritual myths that Morisseau represented visually. Thompson says, the paintings don't make sense. For many collectors, though, the lookalikes pass muster. His art is very easy to forge if you want to do that, says Richard Baker, Morisseau's lawyer from 1975 to 1982, and an active member of Canada's Norval Morisseau Heritage Society, which the artist founded to look after his interests. When you look at the two-dimensional quality of Morisseau's art, you can tell that. It's fairly simple. If you're a skilled forger, you can forge a Morisseau painting quite well, and it would be very difficult to distinguish from an authentic painting. In the last years of his life, Morisseau filed 15 affidavits identifying fakes. That's also when he founded the Norval Morisseau Heritage Society. Between 2001 and 2005, his lawyer sent letters demanding that gallery owners stop selling works the painter claimed he had never seen, let alone created. But by mid-2005, Morisseau was ill and living in a nursing home. The only thing I think about is to paint, he told a reporter. I just want to paint. There are things in my head that I'd like to get out, but right now it can't happen. 2 years later, at age 75, he died. Morisseau's death only emboldened his opponents. Auctioneers, gallery owners, and collectors who wanted to profit from selling paintings of potentially dubious provenance sued the artist's authorized dealer, as well as his lawyer, and others whose claims of widespread Morisseau fraud threatened the value of canvases these sellers had owned, had sold, or might sell. Canadian law enforcement opened an investigation into claims of widespread fraud in 2008, looking primarily at the gallery owners who were profiting from the alleged fakes. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, Canada's version of the FBI, declared its investigation inconclusive, writing in a report to Thunder Bay Police, investigators did not identify nor obtain the requisite evidence necessary to support the allegations of criminal activity. It appeared that someone outside law enforcement would have to enforce the issue if there were going to be any progress in exposing the fraud. Fortunately, several buyers were agency to learn that they may have been sold fakes, including a Scottish-Canadian singer named John McDermott, who in 2013 sued a gallery that sold him a disputed Morisseau. McDermott said that he had conducted his own investigation into the provenance of the painting, which he had come to believe was fake. Moreover, he claimed he could identify the culprits. Among other names, there were two Thunder Bay toughs named Gary Lamont and David Voss, who, he told the courts, produced and resold fraudulent Morisseaus in large numbers, usually large-scale paintings on paper or canvas, like most authentic Morisseau works. According to later comments by Thunder Bay police, Lamont and Voss were veterans of the drug underworld in Thunder Bay, a city of roughly 100,000 that has routinely endured Canada's highest rates of homicide, particularly involving Indigenous peoples. Violent crimes are common amid a struggling economy, a housing crisis, an opiate epidemic, and persistent racial animus among many locals against Indigenous people arriving from reserves across northern Ontario. According to McDermott, The men sold fakes online to collectors, dealers, and auction houses. Indeed, it was Voss who had supplied the auction house outside Toronto for the fakes that aroused Morisseau's attention in 2001. McDermott dropped the claim for unknown reasons, and his representatives did not respond to numerous requests for comment. But other auctioneers, collectors, and buyers began looking to the courts to adjudicate their disputes as well. One of them was a rock star. We are going to pause that article there, and I will finish it on our next program. So to finish out the broadcast today, I will take some Ask Smithsonian questions. You've got questions, we've got experts. Henry C. Peterson of Granite Bay, California asks, could we use volcanic energy as a power source? There is certainly a lot of energy when a volcano erupts, and I do mean a lot. An example, the thermal energy released during the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens was enough to empower the entire world for about 2.5 days. Unfortunately, we cannot capture the energy. If we can capture some of the geothermal energy from magma cooling underground. In places where cooling magma is close enough to the Earth's surface, we can drill wells and then circulate the hot water to either heat buildings directly or generate electricity. Areas with active volcanoes, Iceland, United States, New Zealand, Indonesia, Mexico, Japan, Kenya, tend to be places that have geothermal power. That was Ben Andrews, director of the Global Volcanism Program at the National Museum of Natural History. Jennifer Harvey from Sandpoint, Idaho asks, what's the minimum number of geese needed for an aerodynamic advantage? Even two geese flying together can benefit from aerodynamics. They can switch their positions, taking turns, helping each other by creating air currents. When a flock has three or more members, it can form a V, where each bird helps the birds behind it by creating an upward force of air called upwash. This dynamic has no maximum number. It's more a matter of the need for geese to maintain contact within their flock. It's harder for larger flocks to stay together, as anyone who's traveled in big groups can tell you. That was Sarah Luttrell, researcher of birds and vertebrae zoology at the National Museum of Natural History. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.